Welcome to Theatre Voice, a podcast about performance from the V&A. There's a pub in Battersea in London, not far from the river, with a steep wooden staircase at the back that leads to a slightly rickety auditorium. Despite how that may sound, some of the best new writing I've ever seen has come into being in that rickety auditorium. Theatre 503 is currently one of the only theatres that accepts submissions by first-time writers all year round. It has a fantastic playwriting prize, and the writers it's produced have become the bedrock of UK playwriting, writers like Yasmin Joseph and John Britton. Lisa Sperling became artistic director in 2016, and since then she's been putting some incredible big ideas into practice. They've just abolished venue hire fees, and there are plans to open a new studio space, as well as to make the existing theatre accessible. Despite the theatre's size, it's always punched well above its weight, and Lisa's plans tally with that level of ambition perfectly. Here she talks to Sam Marlowe about those plans and steering Theatre 503 through the straits of the pandemic.
So, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hi.
How are you? It feels like kind of, what would normally be a pleasantries kind of a loaded question after the 2 years we've just had. Tough for artists, tough for us all personally, but some amazing developments at 503. So I guess for you, it's been a sort of crazy couple of years.
Yeah, it feels very crazy, and it feels like, I think it was Rufus Norris who said it, and I read it in an interview, that you wake up every morning and there's a, you know, someone offers you an incredible opportunity, which you're going, can I make that happen? And then the next phone call or email is something that's very challenging and you're trying to solve and firefighting. So I feel like I vacillate between, this is great, can we make this happen and get brilliant people in a room and do something wonderful, to this is absolutely impossible, this is never going to happen, oh God, why is it so hard? So it sort of shifts from moment to moment.
Yeah, roller coaster.
Yeah.
So over the COVID crisis, yep, the last 2 years, was there a point at which you felt like you were in existential crisis at 503?
Yes, I think everybody did, because you couldn't do what you are, your reason for your existence. I think for 503, so for those that don't know, Theatre 503 is a theatre that exists to launch new playwrights and support the creatives that bring their words to life. And so in some respects, we're not a venue, because we're only 63-seater, so we're not a venue that relies entirely on ticket sales, because that wouldn't subsidize, that wouldn't cover the cost of the production. So there is subsidy there, and the shows that we cost quite a bit in our terms, but nothing compared to what they cost in the commercial landscape. So closing and doing nothing almost costs us less than trying to put on shows, and the risk of those shows not selling or needing to raise enough money to put those shows on.
Right.
So actually, when you have a furlough scheme, when you sadly aren't bringing in loads of freelancers into the building and paying those salaries or those fees, actually you save a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. So we were in this ridiculous situation where we couldn't put on shows. We had a core team of staff, many of whom had to be furloughed. And then we went, okay, well, why do we exist and what can we do while this is happening? And actually, so much of our time is spent supporting and developing writers and trying to get those scripts as good as they possibly can be, that actually that gave us a little bit of breathing space to go, okay, this is a play that won't be going on for a year, it might be going on in 2 years. What is the process to get that work as good as it can be? And whether that was rehearsed readings or doing stuff on Zoom or redrafting or dramaturgical support or research time, that time was given. So in some ways, we'll have come out of the pandemic hopefully with the strongest art we've ever had, in the sense of, because the time has been spent and nothing has been rushed. And the second biggest thing was, I've always had issues with the business model of the fringe, of what it is for emerging artists, of how people come into it and how often people are paying for their own shows in order to get a step in the door.
Yeah.
And so we were able to sit down as an organisation and go, these are the things we love about 503, and these are things that work really well, and these are the things that are playing wrong, to be honest, and what can we do now to source it? And it became a very, when all bets are off and you don't even know if you're going to open again as a venue, it's much easier to go to your board and your team and your creatives and go, okay, these are all the things we want to fix, how do we go about doing this? Higher fees are an issue. Our trainee producer scheme is currently voluntary. How people submit scripts to us, what are all our access points as an organisation, what do we do about space, the fact that our theatre is inaccessible, and to go, okay, how do we address each of these points and what are the conversations we have? Which I think when you are which is what we do at 503, go from show to show to show. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have time, as much time to do that, because you're so focused on just getting the shows on.
Yeah. And that's really key, isn't it, about how you funnel talent into the industry?
Yeah.
Because I think for a lot of young theatre makers, whether they've been in training or not, you come out with all this enthusiasm, but you don't have, unless you're very lucky and you get a break and you just, you know, you go straight onto the telly or into the West End or the National, and you're trying to make work of your own, just trying to find somewhere to put it is really tough, isn't it? And there's a, I guess, a class issue there as well. That's really key. What are some of the things then that you're looking at particularly around that?
So the first thing is, and again, to be as upfront as possible, transparent as possible, because I think not everyone can be or is that the 503 model, which is 503 has been going for about 20 years.
Yeah.
And the Latchmere, which is the pub in which we live, or squat, the Latchmere Theatre before that, it's 40 years, so 40 years in total coming up this year. And like so many fringe pubs, it is a room above a pub. And many years ago, our predecessors in the early 2000s took over the space, and someone cleverly worked out that if you were to hire the space out pretty much 365 days of the year, then that would just about bring in enough money. If you were to do it for, I don't know, 30 weeks of the year, that would bring in enough money to cover a little bit of staffing, and then you'd fundraise to do your own shows.
Right.
And so you have this mixture of incoming productions and shows that Theatre 503 or the Latchmere at that time would produce themselves. And then it developed and really focused on new writers, not just new writing. And so that was great, but fundamentally it was about people hiring the space with a bit of a box office split.
Yeah.
And so when I took over the theatre in 2016, it was something that Paul Robinson and Tim Roseman, my predecessor, had looked at a lot as well. It was about going, there was a mixture of all these incredible plays that were coming through to us through unsolicited scripts, through a playwriting award, through our 5035, which are all the different projects that we run. And then it was a case of who could afford to put a show on.
Yeah.
And the majority of the times, often those shows were fantastic, they were being brought to us, but the question was first, who could afford to do it,
yeah,
as opposed to, is this a play we love? And now we are working as hard as possible to get to a point, I think we mainly have, where nearly everything that goes on at 503 has tended to come through the Playwriting Award, through unsolicited scripts, or through the 5035, which is our five writers that are resident with us for a year and a half. And what we then do is matchmake. So we matchmake the writers with directors and with producers to help them produce the show at 503. But they were still having to raise the money to hire the space from us in order to do that. So we were finding these teams and groups of people in order to raise money to hire the space from us to put a show on. And we'd do things like we'd help general manage, they wouldn't have to give us any money up front, it would come out of box office, all of those things. But fundamentally, when you need to raise something like $2,000 a week,
yeah,
just to hire the space before you even think about paying actors, marketing, everything else that goes into doing a show, that still feels prohibitive. Mm-hmm. And quite rightly, lots of the venues, Vaults, Soho Upstairs, weren't doing that and thinking about what that was. We had got ourselves into a situation where our business model completely depended on that, and the risk of us not being able to sustain it and keep it going felt terrifying.
Right.
But you get to a point where you go, that is undermining the artists that we're working with and stopping us being able to access all artists, because it's still prohibitive to put on a show. It relies on Arts Council funding, individual giving, donations, tax relief, but by removing those fees, which is what is the case across the country, and making it about a box office split, meant that as an organisation we were essentially coming in with you and giving as much support as we possibly could, whether that's dramaturgical, whether that's creative, whether that's marketing expertise, whatever a company needs, that we would walk alongside with them and hold the hand. Now the risk is still there, they're still doing the majority of the fundraising coming in the space, but they don't have to hire the venue from us.
Right.
And that feels significant. Mm. And then the other one was in terms of the trainee producers reaching a point where we went, we have to fundraise to make these roles paid roles. Things that have been voluntary for decades,
yes,
just can't be in terms of who comes through and what the access is. And so it almost went, the finances went down to zero to a certain extent. It means you rewrite the budgets and you start again, and you go, as you start creeping back, you go, okay, which are the roles that you protect, which are the ones that you fundraise, how many days a week is it, what can you afford to do, and how do you do it properly to make it at least London living wage, and then build on it from there, which might be that people are working for less hours. That might be that it's a 6-month rolling cycle in terms of our trainee producers. It's scary because as an organisation, you no longer have that cash flow coming in that you had to do. So then it becomes about, okay, how do you shore up your reserves? How do you shore up income streams from other areas to make sure that can kind of in some ways underpin the risk of not of changing your business model?
Yeah. That's a real paradigm shift for the fringe, isn't it, really? Because, I mean, when I trained as an actor many years ago and when I started out, we just used to talk about profit share, which was totally notional. I don't think I ever saw a penny of profit share. And yes, that's where all the money was going on the venue hire, sure, for absolute sure. I mean, that sounds extraordinary to me.
It is, but it also feels like it's the bare minimum. And it's the bare minimum. And it's not anyone's fault. It's about a series of venues and people are buying, paying for rent, electricity and taxes. And you know, so it's... And it's really interesting that outside of London, that is the norm. That is to be expected. So any company coming from outside London go, what? I have to hire it as well. Surely it's a guarantee I should be receiving. I'm bringing you the product and the art.
Yeah.
And that just hasn't been the case in London. And that's, you know, spaces at premium and reputation of venues is what matters. And so, yeah, it's significant and it is already having an impact on who we can work with and how we make the work.
I bet it is, yeah. It's amazing. I mean, you've had some real hits since you've been at 503, and one of the most notable ones has obviously happened during this really tough time with Yasmin Joseph and Juve going onto the TV and going into the West End. Absolutely extraordinary. That must have been really thrilling to watch the genesis of that show.
So, Yasmin is... a prime example of someone who is a writer but doesn't know they are, or is a writer who isn't willing to say they are. So way before I was at 503, Yasmin was a voluntary trainee producer. So she did that. She was with us for a year. No, 6 months, sorry. And at the end of it, I think on her last day, she sat down with Steve, our literary manager, and went, can I chat to you about writing plays? It took her that long to go, I'd like to think about it and do it. She then went to New York. She did a placement over there, a theatre over there, and started writing. And then she applied for our 5035 writers programme. She became one of our 5035 in the same year as Ross Willis and Mahad Ali and various others. And her play Juve is just stunning. But she is a prime example. So this hasn't been planted, but Juve was the first company that we piloted doing the 50-50 box office split. So it wasn't for Juve isn't a play that Theatre 503 produced in-house. It was one of our incoming shows.
Right.
And her and Rebecca Murrell, the director, and their producer Toby formed a company, Bad Breed, in order to produce it themselves, of which we came in on it and contributed something to it in terms of space and time and a little bit of money, and that show was able to happen and then has had the life it's had, but and which is brilliant that it was picked up by Sonia Freeman Productions and then going on to BBC. But yeah, it's a prime example of not, someone once asked me if I had enough money, would I produce every show at 503? And yes, I would produce every show in the sense of going, can we give people the money to do shows, that within a heartbeat. However, there is something extraordinary about what it is as an emerging creative to form a company, to produce a show, to have all that entrepreneurialism, to fundraise for it, to find your philanthropist, to find your audience, to do everything else. And Sam, the first time we ever met was you came to see my play Cotton Wool by Ali Taylor. And as an example of that, I when I left drama school, I had no idea how to really get into the profession. I did a directing course and I volunteered at Theatre 503, and as part of volunteering there, they said I could have a slot, and the show I wanted to do was Cotton Wool, and I formed a theatre company called Buckle for Dust with Ali Taylor and the writer Lou Ramsden and the producer Claire Birch. And we were an incoming show. We hired out the space. We produced that show there. Ali won the Mayor Whitworth Award. It was absolutely the launch of my career in terms of associate directing and becoming a professional director, and was great for the company. Claire went on to produce at the RSC and is now working for the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham, and Lou's not stopped writing since. And so I use myself as an example, but it is that once to have walked in those shoes and to have done that makes you realise that you know, everyone loved Ali's play.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until it went on that it was a game changer for his career. And that's the thing that keeps happening at 503 is people, you know, Yasmin had done the course at Soho, the Soho Writers' Courses. She'd been involved with Tamasha, various other groups. But it's not until you have the show on and someone sees the work mm-hmm. that your career is transformed.
Yeah.
And I think for 503, we just keep going back to, which is different even to America and various other places, you have to have a production. The production is everything. Mm-hmm. And you want that production to be the best it can be. But making a production happen feels, for most writers, like Mount Everest.
Yeah.
It's the final conversion that they can't happen. They can do every course, they can win awards, they win, you know, particularly in the US, they win kind of placements and schemes and various things, but they don't get a production. And that is the game changer in terms of actually having a career in the industry.
Yeah, and the masterclasses and things that you do,
yeah.
I mean, you have some really serious talent involved there. You had Simon Stevens, Jasmine Lee Jones, Anna Jordan. What's the uptake like for that? Are you sort of flooded with people eager to take advantage of it?
Yeah, so interestingly, it is the writers' courses and the success of those that potentially are helping us to underpin the 50-50 split.
Right.
So that's worth knowing in
right.
terms of as a business model and how it could work.
Uh-huh.
So we had always intended to do the courses, and they came out of a need that was coming to us. So we have, Theatre 503, we're the only theatres that receive unsolicited plays year-round. That might not last forever, just in terms of resources, but anyone can send us a play if they're a first-time playwright and yet to have their play produced. But one of the things we kept hearing was, it feels like in the current landscape, although it's starting to change, that if you want to write, you enter competitions, and that might be a way of winning it. It's brilliant. There are so many competitions out there, including our Playwriting Award, Brentwood, and Papa Tango, and everything else. That's fantastic. And then you might do an MA, which currently costs somewhere between 9 and 13, 26 grand.
Yeah.
And then you might, if you're considered talented enough, be invited to go on the course at the Royal Court, or you might do the course at City Lit. But there are very few courses out there that are for anyone to attend and are not prohibitively expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like going and doing a week's retreat somewhere. It's,
yeah.
You know, and they can fit around your time and everything else. And so we had always thought about doing courses because we were being approached so often by writers going, I want to develop my craft, I don't know how to do it, can you matchmake me, can you put me in a room, could you volunteer some masterclasses, what could you do? And then the pandemic happened, and again, the pandemic has not been great, but in some things it has created the space to allow us to do stuff. And this, frankly, allowed us the capacity to go, okay, what's the thing we could offer for writers whilst this is happening? Also, it completely transformed the landscape in terms of Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly, when we talked about doing things online digital, previously Skype, FaceTime, WhatsApp, Instagram stories, and then suddenly Zoom came along, obviously it existed for many people for a long time, but it didn't seem to have reached theatre. And then we went, oh, hang on, everything we were going to do in person, which we had planned to do in person, depending on space at 503, we can now do online. And not only does that blow the doors off in terms of access, it means that anyone from across the country, across the world, which is what we now have, can access these courses. So a year before, in the summer, we had run a pilot scheme in person at 503, and we'd come up against, as we always do, which we'll get onto, huge issues of accessibility in terms of physical. So the Lakshmi, for those that don't know, Theatre 503 at the Lakshmi is up a series of steps.
Very steep steps.
Yeah. No accessible bathroom facilities. It's just not accessible, physically accessible.
Yeah.
And so suddenly we went, oh, hang on a minute. Everything we're doing online, we can reach out to all of these practitioners, our alumni. We were also going, how do these practitioners and these brilliant writers, many of whom are alumni, how do they earn a living during the pandemic? So that was another thing in terms of particularly the long form courses, but paying a chunk of money. And also the other thing that happened, which was reciprocated, is alumni constantly saying, how can we support you?
Right.
And not necessarily having the financial means to support us, but having the artistic reputation background to go, I'll offer you 3 hours of my time to run a masterclass, or to do a house. We ran a series of how-tos, which we'll be bringing back again. I can offer my expertise running a how-to. And so I think pretty much everyone we have approached to do either a course or a masterclass or a Q&A has said yes, or they've said yes, I'll do it in the future. Because I don't know anyone who, if they've been on this journey of trying to forge a life in this ridiculous industry doesn't go, yeah, I'd like to help someone else do it as well. Yeah. And everyone's run a different path. And so, yeah, it hasn't stopped really. And then we now have waiting lists for pretty much all of our courses. So if they don't get, because it's only space for 14 participants,
right,
per course. Because that was the idea. It wasn't trying to be a kind of Zoom webinar. It was actually you're in the room, you build a relationship, you get to know the practitioner, you're there for a period of time. Sometimes they're reading your work, doing different things. And the other biggest thing was, as part of the reaching out to the Arts Council for CRF funding and various other things, was to solicit funding for our Share the Drama programme. And our Share the Drama programme means that it subsidises all our tickets, so that every Saturday it's pay what you decide for our matinees, it subsidises our writers' nights, but also it offers free places, 25% free places for everyone on these courses. So that means that anyone who can't afford it just fills in a form and they get put on the course for free. So no one should be able to, should be saying, I can't afford to do this.
That's incredible.
That exists. And so the funding for that has so far kept coming, which is brilliant in terms of Share the Drama. And it means that accessibility wise, you know, we've got people now joining us from New York, we've got practitioners joining us from New York, we've got people in Europe joining us, Australia joining us. So suddenly, you know, we've always tried to be as international as possible in relation to the Playwriting Award, but it means the 503 studio courses just build and build and build and build and build. So actually the problem we've got now, which is joyous, but we're sorting it, is if people have signed up, they're signing up so quickly for the next lot, that how do we reach more and more people,
right,
and reach out to those that might not know that writing's for them, or that feel slightly intimidated by it, or don't know the courses that are happening. So it's a lovely problem to be going, actually, how do we want or in it the, those that have attended to before to come back again, but we also want to protect places for others that haven't yet had the chance to do it.
Yeah, that's really key, isn't it, that kind of idea of accessibility and diversity.
Yeah.
I think it really sort of was crystallised, wasn't it, that during the COVID period, well, we're still in the COVID period, but the worst of it, in a way that there's always been, or for a long time, there's been a lot of lip service around those kind of ideas, but suddenly it became really stark who was going to survive this and who wasn't,
and who was worst hit. And it's completely about not only who accesses, but who then, I don't know, is stuck on the travelator and gets to go further and develop further. And I think for us, we're really implicit and explicit that Theatre 503, as well as, you know, to provide a great night out for our audience, exists to be a pipeline of talent. Mm-hmm. And that communication with the bigger venues and the producers, and not just in theatre, but, you know, the TVs, the Netflix, the streaming services, their relationship with us and seeing the work and meaning that either shows have future life and they transfer, which is lovely when they do, but that people can see the work and read the work after and basically get people jobs. Like I'm really, you know, on Milk and Gore that we've just done, whoever didn't have an agent, like spending all our time to get them an agent,
right,
or seeing, you know, that's partly why critics coming to see the work is so important, because that gives it a future. But also the big thing that's happened again due to the pandemic is we live stream for the first time. And initially live streaming was about what can we put on which our audiences can't see, so that last year, not this, 2019, was the Panto. And this year, you know, for Foxes, which closed early because of COVID,
right,
and Milk and Gore, which had an international writer, and whilst we got to have a full run, it was a fun run as well, those live streams and the Panto that we just did this Christmas, they are now the calling card.
Mm.
And doing that in a way that, you know, when we did Wolfie, we had a camcorder at the back of the auditorium filming it, as opposed to working, which we do now with the wonderful Chocolate Films, who are a brilliant filmmaking company, who come in and film it properly. I mean, it's probably not NT Live quality, but it's properly vision mixed, it's proper cameras, it's proper audio, which means that not only is it live streamed so anyone who couldn't make the show can see it from across the world, you also then have that copy, which then becomes that artist and that writer and that creative team's calling card.
And yes,
someone goes, which you've always had, I'm so sorry, I didn't see it, invite me to your next show. You're able to go, no, here it is, if you want to watch it, as opposed to just read the script. And that is transformative. That is a game changer. So again, the pandemic, horrific, but in terms of moving us along technologically and as an audience being ready to watch and receive things online, that makes a massive difference.
Let's talk a bit more about the Playwriting Award, because you've got one of those coming up in the new season, which is Moreno, which of course I've read.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to be on the panel.
Brilliant.
So how's that coming along?
It's fantastic. We go into rehearsals in 2 weeks' time. and the wonderful Nancy Medina.
Yes,
who's got Trouble in Mind on at the National at the moment.
It's
fantastic. So they are busy getting everything ready to go into rehearsals. It's an incredible play. Well, first of all, it's got American footballers in it, so the Theatre 5 with You stage is going to be filled with the scale and the size with American footballers in their dressing rooms having various conversations. But what I feel is so special about it is exploring someone making a stand. So it centres around footballers responding in their changing rooms and talking about Colin Kaepernick and taking the knee and what that means to a black man, what that means to a Mexican man, what that means to a white man, what that means to different ages, and when you make a stand and what it costs, and whether you only make a stand because it matters to you or whether you make a stand because it matters to society. And it does it in a very funny, irreverent, impolite, comic but also important way. And it talks about the idea of American football as another form of slavery and still being in the field and being paid to be in the field. And when you think about those incredible football stars and extortionate fees and how the sport is another way of oppression in a certain way, and you know, you're only allowed to be successful in the form of sports as opposed to another means. And it's, yeah, it's a play. It's a play that no one can stop talking about. Like, everyone is getting very excited about it, and it feels, to be honest, like a play we still haven't seen.
Is that a particularly exciting challenge for you as a theatre maker yourself to get big ideas into a small, intimate space?
Totally. Yeah. The bigger the better, and that, as you know from seeing my work, the more unstageable the better.
Yeah.
And so, when someone says, how are you going to put a football field on a stage the size of 503, or how are you going to take someone to the moon, or how do you have them emerging from the womb as they were in Wolfie, or how do you put the entire Notting Hill Carnival on stage as they did in Juve?
Yeah.
That's the gig, that's the provocation. And frankly, it's really easy because the audience walk in the door and you go, imagine something, and we'll take you with it, and we'll make it as easy as possible for you to imagine, and we'll hold you for that 90 minutes or 2 hours, and you'll stay with us. And I think because you're in the room together, there's nowhere to go. I think people are much more willing to take a leap of faith because, not that it's poor theatre necessarily, but they know the limitation of your resources, so they know their imagination's going to be needed, and they come willing and able to do that.
Yeah, it's having some renovations at the moment, isn't it? The theatre
503.
Yeah.
So what our intention is, so another thing that came out of the pandemic was Nine Elms, which is down the road from Zimbabwe, which is where you have the American Embassy and various other incredible new places, including a set of flats that have a floating swimming pool between them, is as part of a Section 106, which is where, when they're doing new developments, they look at, the local council looks at how there can be an offering for the local community. And one of the things they were interested in, a cultural residency from a theatre. And we were lucky enough, talented enough, whatever you want to call it, to secure one of these spaces. So the dream for me has always been, there's been lots of questions about Theatre 503 and where it should live. And it's been above the Latchmere for, as we said, 20 years. And there's been a theatre there for 40 years. And I hate that it's inaccessible, but I love the space.
Yeah.
I love that the foyer especially. I just feel like it has soul. Like, plays have gone on there and people have seen such brilliant work there. And it's not part of a new development building site, no offence to theatres that are. But it has something. Even though, you know, if you live nearby, it's great. If you live North London, you're going, oh my God, I have to get a bus to get there, or walk from Clapham Junction. Whatever that is, I understand that. And obviously the tube is creeping closer. But I feel as though, I always wanted to stay at Theatre 503, but I hated that it was inaccessible, and I hate that I'm a director who loves directing in the round or in thrust or end on, anything that brings you as close to the action as possible, and Theatre 503 currently is an end on space. So I was always a bit like, why can't it be a flexible configuration like the gate is and various others?
Right.
So when we secure this new space, which will be the 503 studio, and again, the dream for that came from, I've been lucky enough as a practitioner to go to places like in New York. There's somewhere called The Lark, which is entirely a new writers, well, not new writers actually, a writers development space, which is this sort of incredible place that has rehearsal rooms, little areas for writers to work, workshop spaces, and it exists purely to support and develop writers in writing the best play possible. And then you have somewhere like the National Theatre Studio, which exists to as the engine room for the National Theatre, where you just go in and you feel the buzz of creatives creating brilliant work that may end up on the National Theatre stage or may end up in other theatres across the world. But there is an engine room for stuff happening. And what I felt like I needed at Theatre 503 was the engine room of Theatre 503, which is all the work that we've done off-site in other rehearsal rooms or other workshop spaces, or, you know, sit in the Royal Court Cafe to have a dramaturgical conversation. And wanted to get to the point where we were able to home all of that. So to create, essentially, I call it the baby National Theatre Studio. They might not like that. But I call it the Theatre 503 Studio,
yeah,
which exists for emerging playwrights,
right,
and their creatives. And that will be rehearsal rooms. It will be where our offices are, because the 503 office at the moment has always been the foyer.
Yeah.
And will be fully accessible, and will mean that we can do events there. We can do all the studio courses that we currently do online. We can also do in person for people that want stuff in person. We can run all the community work that we've tried to do over the years, which means that, you know, some people aren't comfortable coming to a space that's above a pub, either,
sure,
for religious reasons or because they're recovering alcoholics or because they don't want to walk through loads of football supporters on a Saturday. Some people love that it's above a pub and, mm-hmm, they can come and have a meal and have a drink afterwards. So for me, the space at Nine Elms will be everything you could ever hope for in terms of the resources that you need to support a writer at the very beginning and to re-rehearse their plays or develop their plays or workshop their plays and get creatives together, and a space for producers to come in and to try things out. Anyway, it'll be, in my mind, it'll be magical. So we've secured the space, and what that means is that the developers, Galliard, give us a financial contribution, they give us peppercorn rent, the council is helping us to try and make that happen, but we still need to raise huge amount of money in order to do that, which is very overwhelming as an artistic director that's never done that before. But there are trusts and foundations that exist to support capital as well as individuals. And at the same time, when we were having all these conversations about that new space, there was the realisation, and it's always been very much on the list to try and transform the Latchmere, that we might potentially have a set of creatives or a writer or audience member who can participate in the work at Nine Elms but still couldn't physically access the space at the Latchmere.
Right.
And that felt disingenuous, that you could be in the rehearsal room, that you could spend all your time at the 503 studio at Nine Elms, but you still couldn't physically access the space at the Latchmere.
Sure. Yeah.
And when talking to the board and talking to fundraising development, I was like, come on, if we're doing this, we're doing this as well. And so the brilliant TSA architects we've got on board are looking at how those two spaces are connected and how you build a lift at Theatre 503 and take it up, how you level out the foyer, and how you make it that your entrance into the theatre, rather than going up the steps as it used to be, mm-hmm, still keeps that but enables you to go along the side, what was backstage but won't be backstage anymore, and can take us into the side of the theatre. And that space can still be end on but also could be reconfigured to be a thrust space or potentially in the round.
Right.
That's what we're exploring at the moment.
How exciting.
And that is a set of financial questions as well as a set of artistic questions.
Sure.
But if it's one thing that will be my legacy is to make that space accessible, then I'll stand by that and do all I can to make it happen.
Amazing. So what sort of date are you looking at? Do you have
The next 2 years.
Right.
Yeah. So 2023.
So the upcoming season, it will look as it's.
Oh, I say that. Yeah, nothing. I mean, it's had a lick of paint and it's, yeah, a bit cleaner because we've not been there for a while.
Right.
But yeah, nothing. Nothing is changing yet.
Okay, so
yeah,
we're probably talking sort of late 2023,
2024.
Yeah.
I'm going to say,
yeah,
further into the distance to give us more time. Yeah.
That's so exciting. So you yourself as an artist,
yeah,
you're also doing some work with the producer Eleanor Lloyd, whose,
yes,
lovely offices we're sitting in,
yeah,
for this chat. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I think that there's something extraordinary when you've been a director, and so before I got the job at Theatre 503, I had volunteered there many years before, and as I said, got my break with Cotton Wool directing there. I then went off and assisted and associate directed across the UK and across the world, and that was really exciting, and then got to a point where I was directing three or four shows a year and doing pretty well as a freelance director. But I always felt like different people have their different routes into directing. I started off at the Albany in Deptford. I ran their community theatre programme as part of the National Theatre and the work they did at the Albany in Deptford. And so for me, it's always run parallel, which is this idea of putting on shows and how do we talk about who's seeing the work and who's making the work. And so when the job at Theatre 503 came up, I had been the regional coordinator for the JMK Trust's director's programme. So I had been across the country for about 4 years running workshops and handing out directing placements to directors to give them their first gig, their first paid gig in the theatre as an assistant director on shows. And the conversations I've been having constantly is, how do I get my first break? How do I get my first break? It's untenable. I've done every course going, I've done every workshop going. It hasn't resulted in a career. How do you put shows on? How can anybody do this?
Yeah.
And the reality of, you know, I'm very old now, but when I went to university, I didn't have to pay tuition fees, and I came out of university and I moved to London, and to be frank, I did loads of jobs, but I got into debt putting on shows, and that was how I did it. But it now feels like a privilege that I could even get into debt, because I didn't already have 40 grand's worth of debt from going to university.
Sure.
So it's always been there for me, which is who gets to make the work and how the work is made. And when 503 came up, it felt like the perfect chance to bring all of my experience working with directors, all of my experience as a director, and what 503 does brilliantly, which is find brilliant writers and producers, and to put that together and to matchmake. And that has been, you know, the best 6 years I think I've been there, 2016, five, 6 years of my life doing that. However, what it means when you're an artistic director of an organisation, and one where I was very clear that it wasn't about me directing every show at 503, so I probably do one a year, and in that sometimes it's one every 2 years that I actually direct. It was all about going, giving people their opportunity to develop their career, to professionalise. But there is a part of you that goes, I had directed on some of the biggest stages in the country, I had my own theatre company which was developing plays and projects, and most of that came to a halt when I started at 503. I directed at Hampstead quite a bit, and I've directed other venues and had conversations, but the focus has been there. And that's important, and that stays as that. But there is part of you that is continuing to have those conversations with brilliant writers, continuing to develop projects, and a skill set that you're not using as much, because so much of what you're focused on is first-time creatives.
Yeah.
And so Eleanor Lloyd, who I knew for a long time, she's been involved with Theatre 503, she's been on the board there, she was having conversations about reaching a stage in her company of actually having lots of projects that she was trying to drive forward and needed someone to have the momentum, help her with the momentum to do that. So that's basically what I do. In fact, all of our meetings have the word momentum at the top, because you have this fantastic set of artists, and in Eleanor's case, the resources as a West End producer to think about the long-term plan, which is about those long-term commissions and partnering with other theatres across the country and other producers to develop ideas that are more commercial. And I think what I'm interested in is 503, when people talk about risk-taking, but for 503, the riskier the work, the better. That's the work that does brilliantly for us.
Yeah.
Whatever you associate with risk, and that might be the demographic of the writer, that might be how mind-blowing the form is, that might be the way the story is told, that might be the subject matter, those are the plays for us that do brilliantly. That isn't the case necessarily commercially.
Sure.
So what is that bridge between the two where you go, actually, it's the quality of the work, such as Juve, is so good,
mm-hmm.
or Rotterdam, for example, and is so on the mark, on the zeitgeist with what we're saying and in conversation with our times, how does that then translate into the mainstream, which isn't necessarily about going, everything at 503 needs to be in the West End.
Sure.
But is about going, those writers and those ideas, which I am drawn to, how do we amplify them so they can hold a space in the West End? And what about all the writers that have come out of 503, all the writers that might not necessarily start at 503, but are brilliant writers, how do we get them commissioned and get their work on? So it feels like a happy partnership that means complements the work that I do at 503, but also selfishly means that I'm thinking about bigger stages, bigger spaces,
mm-hmm.
both as a director but as someone who is driving projects forward. So it's not necessarily about me directing them, it's absolutely about making projects happen
mm-hmm.
with the right creative teams, which I'm doing all the time at 503, but I'm now also doing it with artists who've been doing it for 30 years as opposed to artists that are just starting out.
Fantastic. Just one more thought. I just wondered how you're feeling generally about theatre as an art form and how it moves forward from this sort of strange point that we've reached at the end of a crisis. I know there are commercial producers that are really suffering and really struggling, and I think Sonia Friedman described it as a bloodbath a week or so ago. How are you feeling generally about theatre and its future in the UK?
There's not an easy answer. I went to see Measure for Measure at the Globe the other week, Blanche McIntyre's wonderful production, and there was a moment on stage where there was someone in the audience and they were reading the play, You know how sometimes people go to, they've bought the play text and they read it. And the, and the, and the actor, the wonderful Eloise Secker, came out. She spotted it. And she went, careful, because I'm going to go off book. And the whole audience just lost it. They just couldn't contain themselves. And the guy was embarrassed and following. And she didn't. And then she checked at the end going, was I right? And this guy went, I think he said something like, word perfect. And everyone cheered. And I just thought, that doesn't happen anywhere. Like, it was, and it's so cliched, because I, you know, it's the same as live sports. It's the same as live music. It is what happens in the room, in that show, in that moment. And, you know, you can have all the live streams in the world and you can have everything else, but until you're in a space and seeing people over this last year come back for Foxes and for Milk and Gall and for the Panto, and they just, and they love it. So in that sense, yes, people come and they love it. However, if I was to talk to my family, if I was to talk to people outside of London, tourists that, you know, were the sort of mainstay of our audiences, then no, that they're not coming. Mm. And that's terrifying. And, you know, when you're working out what your budgets are and can you do a panto because will audiences come, and do you risk it again because there's nothing to underpin it,
Yeah. Then
that is terrifying. So I sort of have to take the long game and go, will theatre survive? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Was there a plague in 2018, essentially, Spanish flu, and did it take 5 years before we even thought about being back to normal?
Yes.
Is that our time frame that we just have to go, will there be some brilliant developments, online work, coming together, really thinking about human resources, really thinking about hours, thinking about how we pay people, respecting the artists? Yes. Will we lose 50% of our freelance community because they go, why would I stay doing this? Mm-hmm. This is, and actually, the move into TV and other art forms, because they suddenly went, oh, that's where the work is, why would I come back? Like, let the genuine drain of stage management, lighting, sound, designers, talent drain, we have lost them.
Right.
And will they come back? Why would you? So you come back because you love that room, but can you afford to come back? So those things, yeah, it's two sides of it. I think theatre will survive, I think the work will be great. But when I sit down to a first-time writer and go, actually, we're pretty much programmed now till 2023, and we're going to then do a refurb, so that means we're not programming till 2024, 25. It's 2022.
Yeah.
That feels a long time away.
Yeah.
And how, you know, one of the questions I've been asked is, you're running all these incredible courses, you know, you have all these, you know, for the Playwriting Award, I think you've received nearly 2,000 players from 45 countries. Not all of those people are going to have a production. So what is that? And then you go, not everyone who writes a song gets a hit record, but is there something in the making of it? Is there something in telling the story that you want to tell and having creatives read it out loud or have someone read it? So there's got to be a celebration in the doing of it, as opposed to, will everything be a West End transfer? Will everything end up on BBC Arts? And I really believe in that, in terms of who we are and what that means to us. So yeah, I am eternally optimistic, but how we make the world feel confident enough to go and sit in a room with other people. And actually, you know, just not to timestamp this, but, you know, someone announcing, great, you can take masks off in the theatre.
Mm.
I don't cheer at that.
No.
Because it made me feel better going to the theatre that everyone's wearing a mask.
Yes.
And I know a huge amount of people felt the same way.
I absolutely did.
So it actually, that saddens me in a way, because I go, well, it's not asking much to ask people to keep their masks on. And if it makes other people feel more comfortable and safe, great, let's do it. Mm. So those things, it's mixed messages, isn't it? And it's, are we safe? Are we not? Is cancelling? We're not. And we just have to go, you know, how do, you know, the questions around vaccination and what it means if you have an unvaccinated performer and the impact that could have on a show by wiping it out for 10 days if they need to isolate, which was the current legislation, I know it's changing, compared to someone vaccinated, and then going, well, I don't want to not employ someone because they're not, for various reasons, which are their own personal reasons, but what does that mean? So
yeah.
there's really tough conversations that feel divisive as opposed to unifying. So how we work through those feels really important, and how we just don't lose everyone, lose talent.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the key thing, isn't it, above all. Yeah. Thank you so much.
No,
it's really great to talk to you.
Sam Marlowe was talking to Lisa Sperling. Theatre Voice is an audio archive of conversations about British theatre, and there are hundreds more interviews on theatrevoice.com, so have a dig around. The producers are Tim Bano and Helen Gush. Thanks for listening.